This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL, Kenai Soldotna, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Nyman, and it's time for the Kenai Conversation. We are looking ahead to spring. Yes, it is still winter, but we will turn the corner eventually. And when we do, all you gardeners out there need to have your plans and your plant starts ready. So, we are sharing a presentation from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District on Know Your Lands. That's a series that they're doing throughout the winter on Zoom. You can find out more on their Facebook page, Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. The speaker this week was Sean Jakinski of Green Cannon Gardens in Nanilchik. He is a homegrown boy in Nanilchik and specializes in growing native Alaska perennial vegetables. Didn't know there was such a thing as growing your own native vegetables? Well, stay tuned to find out how. Here's Sean.
My name is Sean Jakinski. I'm a longtime Alaskan gardener hailing from Nanilchik here on a chunk of my family's homestead. While my interests are pretty broad when it comes to the plant world, my main focus is on the growing and propagating of regionally appropriate perennial food and resource crops and working out home garden systems that incorporate these crops, which are designed to be as resilient, diverse, and productive as possible. I've been referred to by some as being an Alaska jungle gardener. The majority of our gardening efforts take place outside, and while we do offer forms of protection to speed our crops along or get an early start, such as cold frames and row cover, we have reached the point where our main goal is simplicity. So direct fall or spring seeding and starting seeds outside to bypass the trauma of hardening off plants started in the greenhouse. The picture to the right is what many, if not all of you, would recognize as cow parsnip or pushki, Heraclium lantanum. What many of you might not know is that the name pushki evolved out of the Russian word for cannon, pushka, which seems a very appropriate name when you look at how its incredible flowers, umbels that can easily reach over a foot in diameter, appear to be exploding out of their large hollow green stalk. So in a sense, our farm, Green Cannon Gardens, is the namesake of this lovely plant. By the way, if you've never stopped to smell the subtle sweet scent of a pushki flower, I would strongly encourage you to try it out next summer. It's really one of my favorites. So during the winter, our animal family is our main focus. We free range a flock of chickens that has a fluctuating population of around 40 to 100 birds. Our chicken system is simple. We try not to go into winter with over 60 birds, and with a combination of broody hens and an incubator, we try to add anywhere from 15 to 30 chicks to the cluck each summer. We keep them for both eggs, which we both eat and sell, and meat, which we consume, sending most of our roosters and four-year-old hennies to freezer camp. Most of the proceeds from the eggs that we sell are saved for purchasing wintertime feed. And we get kitchen refuse from two of our local restaurants year-round. During the busy times of the year, we can easily be bringing in 150 to 200 pounds of kitchen refuse twice a week. So combined with the food they forage from an easy 5 acres of range, and the feed purchased with egg money, the cost of keeping our flock is very low. And considering the fact that we get as much eggs and chicken meat as we can eat out of the deal, our cost often reaches into the negatives. The chickens also provide a large amount of incredibly rich manure and are efficient compost turners and vigorous land tillers. The chickens are definitely the workhorses of our homestead. And while we are on a goat break at this particular moment, in the past 3 or 4 years, we have had a herd of 3 to 9 goats, keeping 3 ladies for milk and eating or selling their babies. our goat system, it was a little more time intensive. During non-snowy times, we would range them out on about 30 acres of neighboring land until they would fill up, usually about 2-hour walks, shorter during the summer and longer during the fall and winter. And we would also harvest large amounts of willow, birch, cottonwood, spruce, elderberry, and alder branches, as well as fireweed and wormwood stalks to augment the local hay that was the staple of their diet. It's definitely tricky to keep goats and gardens at the same time. That's why we're on a goat break. And during this break, we will be working on establishing a solid forageable hedge and paddock system. So while our main focus is on perennial crops, we also do a lot of annual gardening with a heavy focus on regionally appropriate staple crops. So potatoes, carrots, turnips, beets, both snap and soup peas, bulbing onions. And our primary methods of preservation are dehydrating, freezing, and root cellaring. We have a pretty substantial root cellar that we dug by hand. It can easily hold 2,000 pounds of roots, food. The only machines used in the building process was a chainsaw to cut the logs and a four-wheeler to drag the logs to the cellar. The design was inspired by first Alaskan architecture, particularly the semi-subterranean houses of the Denaina. The cellar itself took a grand total of around $100 to build, and that was money spent replacing the two shovels and one mattock we broke while digging the pit. It took about 3 weeks to finish. Definitely a lot of work, but well worth it. The inside temperature hovers between 35 and 40 degrees year round, with pretty high atmospheric humidity, making it perfect for roots, but not the greatest for cabbages. I wanted to note that there are a lot of incredible ways to go about building very effective root cellars on a smaller scale too. We went this route because we needed the space. It just basically looks like a hole in the ground from outside. It's just a really simple bulkhead door with a piece of plywood that we throw a couple bales of hay on top of to insulate during the wintertime. And we use salvaged oak 4x4s for support and pallets for the inside. Really simple, really effective. The product that we sell most are eggs. We provide eggs weekly to anywhere from 6 to 13 households by delivery. And honestly, the demand far outweighs the our output, and we always have a wait list a mile long. Second in line would be berries. We've had seasons where we'll bring in over 300. We grow 12 different types of berries and various cultivars of many of those. And thirdly, our potted perennial food plants, more types than we have time to list here. And really, we probably give away more plants than we sell. We're also really into bartering and trading a lot. Our gardens are by far the heart of our operation. Collectively, we have at least 2 acres under cultivation at this point, and we're adding to that every year. And most of that is perennial. Our process is simple. We begin by running a chunk of land under annual cultivation for ideally 3 to 4 years, amending the soil every season with as much organic goodness as possible, compost, manure, seaweed, beach stuff, forest stuff, wood ash, river sand, and as much mulch as we can manage. During this time, letting our chickens scratch and manure a new unworked annual plot. And after a few years, we open up that new annual plot and transition the old annual plot into perennial production. So our gardens are always growing. Put simply, 3 years under annual production, transition to perennial production, new annual patch, repeat. In our perennial gardens, we strive for high biodiversity. At this point, we are actively propagating, encouraging, and carefully managing over 140 species of food and multi-purpose resource plants in our gardens. Our garden mosaic is a careful combination of plant communities and standalone polycultures with dense plantings that become quite jungly in the summertime. So in this little 200 square foot chunk of our garden, there are at least 15 species of plants. High bush cranberry, skunk currant, Goodke and Henry, Chenopedium bonus integris. We grow it for its delicious seed. It's kind of like a perennial quinoa. Flatleaf chive or Allium sinensis. Garden sorrel, wild geranium, salmonberry, Sicca burnet, a propagation of wild chives, yarrow, a row of heritage red currants along the back, a ground cover of strawberry. There's second year garlic. There's even rattleweed, the Rhinanthus minor. It's really cool, a native plant, and a few Jacob's ladder. So there's a lot of advantages to growing perennial food crops. Being gardeners of the far north, we're always looking for ways to extend our growing season. We want to be able to utilize every second of that seasonal window. So this is one of the incredible benefits of growing perennial vegetables, is that established perennial food crops operate as a type of season extension, often offering harvests in very early springtime and late into the fall. So before your earliest springtime annual crops have made it past even the seedling stage, you'll have already brought in your first major harvests of shoots, leaves, roots, bulbs, tubers, easily adding a month of time to your growing season. And with the right combination of plants, kind of creating this wave of harvests that lasts pretty much from the first day of spring to the last day of fall. You know, another advantage is that once mature, the majority of time required with perennial food plants is just seasonal maintenance and harvest. So, you know, whereas with annual crops, the springtime routine entails tilling and bed formation and getting starts going and hardening off starts and transplanting starts and, you know, setting up ways to protect your crops, et cetera. But with perennial crops, the springtime routines are with woody shrubs. It's basically just pruning and propagating if necessary. With herbaceous perennials, you're propagating and weeding if needed or desired. Of course, there's time involved in getting the plants established. A lot of these perennial crops will take years to get to the point where they're mature, where you're actually harvesting from them or where it's safe to harvest from them. So there is that to take into consideration is the initial establishing of the plant. You're preparing the bed once, but you're preparing it with the thought in your head that this plant is going to be here forever. A lot of these perennial plants will outlive you. So that's, you got to think about that. So you want to beef up the soil as much as you can and, you know, take as good care of it throughout the seasons too, which pretty much means that kind of seasonal maintenance would also include through the summertime, weeding if it seems like there's some competition from other plants. And or just mulching, a lot of mulching and amending top dressing, you know, because these plants will be there for your grandchildren, maybe even your grandchildren's grandchildren. That's an enormous benefit of this. These crops will outlive you a lot of the time, a lot of these will. And also perennial crops are much more resilient in the face of climatic extremes, which more than ever now is important because there is really massive changes going on in the climate worldwide, especially up here. I mean, there's clear changes. I mean, yesterday's in the middle of January, it was like 40 degrees here in Nenelchik. That's bizarre. You know, like, I mean, within the last 6 years, there's been a really enormous change. That's the cool thing about perennial plants is that in the faces of like extreme cold, you know, depending you have a climate appropriate plant, extreme cold, drought tolerant, you know, which is also important. Like a lot of our gardens don't really get watered a lot. There's been plenty of years where they don't ever get watered. Parts of our garden, in mature parts of our garden, sometimes don't even get watered during the season. So that's also another advantage, is they're really resilient to climactic extremes. So heat, cold, drought, a flood, like a lot of rain. So while choices for perennial food crops seem limited here in Alaska, there is actually a pretty impressive proven selection spanning all types of produce, leaf, stem and stalk, root and tuber and bulbs, seed and grain, fruit, of course, flowers and broccolis and possibly nuts. And excitingly, this list is growing. The main reason the choices seem limited is because there's not much attention paid to perennial agriculture here in Alaska, which is wild considering the incredible possibilities that perennial food crops present. There are hundreds of promising perennial crops that could possibly be successfully grown here in South Central Alaska. Here at our farm, we do our best to try at least a couple new crops every year. I would highly recommend anyone interested in pursuing perennial agriculture to go for it on whatever scale they desire. And along with those true types, not to hesitate to bring in perennial crops that have yet to prove themselves. We would be happy to act as a resource for lists of promising untrialed crops, as well as a source for propagules of true crops. I would like to move on to discussing five plants that are a very important and exciting part of our gardens. The first two being more commonly known, alder, particularly Ulnus crispa, and true comfrey, Symphytum officinale, and then three other lesser known perennial vegetables that we've been trailing in our gardens for the last 5 to 6 years. Turkish rocket, Bunius orientalis, Caucasian spinach, or Hublitzia tamnoides, and sweet sisley, or Murus odorata. And while all of these plants have effective medicinal applications, I will primarily be focusing on their culinary and practical uses on the farm. So alders are one of those plants here on the Kenai Peninsula that don't really need much of an introduction. These sprawling, multi-trunked, deciduous shrubs range from 4 to 20 feet tall and can form dense thickets. Alder is one of, if not the most, underutilized and underappreciated of trees here in Alaska. It's incredibly adaptable and can be found from the coastline all the way up to the subalpine, and seems to thrive in just about any type of soil. It is abundant and infinitely useful, so I just wanted to shine some light on some of its many virtues. Because it's wintertime, I wanted to start by focusing on alder as an incredible and sustainable source of firewood. Because of alder's multi-trunk form, vigorous growth, and incredible abundance, it's not difficult to manage patches as a continuous fuel crop. 20 trunks to one tree is not unusual. One could come up with many reliable ways to manage patches. At the most extreme side of the spectrum, I imagine a healthy alder could tolerate losing all of his trunks once every 10 years or so, as long as one was careful to leave plenty of strong shoots and a solid knob of trunk for it to revegetate from. I have certainly seen many an alder spring back after losing all of its top growth, though not all alder would survive this. Another more conservative way to go about this would be to take anywhere from 1/3 to 1/2 of the trunks at a time, cutting in a way that encouraged trunk formation and always focused on the removal of older growth and allowing time for regrowth between harvests, probably about every three or four years. The benefits of this method of harvest is manyfold. Trees managed this way are not killed. In fact, if done correctly, this method substantially extends the tree's life. Because the trunks aren't very large in diameter, it's not difficult to do the majority of harvesting and bucking with a large lopper and a sharp limbing axe. And Because it is such small diameter, splitting of rounds is in many cases not necessary. Smaller diameter also means quicker curing time. What you see in the picture is at least 3 very toasty days of firewood in our house. It didn't take me any longer than an hour of light work to harvest it, a sharp large lopper being my only tool. It is best to harvest while the trees are dormant, so from November to April, but they can be cut any time of the year. It doesn't take any longer than a year to dry, and the smaller diameter piece is even curing within the 5 warmer months of the year. And while I do love burning spruce and birch, and we burn a lot of it, alder is hands down some of the finest firewood available here in Alaska, and it makes a great addition to the firewood pile. And for those of you that might be curious, cured alder bumps out around 17 to 19 million BTUs per cord. Alder as a forage for livestock has a very limited but noteworthy application in the context of keeping goats. For those of you that might not know, goats are browsers, which means they eat grasses and herbaceous plants, but focus most of their attention on woody shrubs. This, along with their cold hardiness, makes them eminently suited for South Central Alaska's climate and native browse. They have a unique digestive system that requires the lignin from the wood to keep their gut active and healthy. And lucky for us, Ulnus crispa, which is one of the most prevalent types of alder on the Kenai, is considered the most palatable of Ulnus species. Alder can act as a supplemental goat feed year round. It is at its most desirable in the summertime when in full leaf. Full limbs or even trunks can be cut and brought to the goats, or sprawling trunks can be weighed down to make the green leaves, which the goats target, more accessible. While during the winter, alder is not goat's first choice, that would be elderberry and willow, which has bark that peels off like long noodles. It does provide a good wintertime fare. The goats go for all the male pollen producing catkins first, moving on to the winter leaf buds, along with all the branches a quarter inch or smaller, and then over time we'll eat off most of the bark. A combined firewood and goat forage system works very well with alder. Simply cut the branches, give them to the goats, and once the goats are finished with them, which usually takes 2 or 3 days, unless the branches are really big, just buck and stack the wood in a dry, airy spot. When goats are freely foraging and aren't allowed to over-browse a single area, they won't kill alders, especially if there is more desirable browse. This, of course, all depends on the amount of goats and size of area being browsed. However, if pinned in with alders, goats are more than happy to turn mature alders into firewood, whether you want them to or not. Alder thickets, especially younger ones, are important wintertime feeding areas for snowshoe hare, which is good news if you are like me and like to eat them. Look for signs of them after a fresh dusting of snow. That's when the tracks are the clearest, as well as droppings. And their conspicuous urine, which often has a reddish tinge. And this red is caused by eating the alder. This also happens to goats, where it'll dye their urine red. This comes from the inner bark of the alder, which can actually be boiled and can yield a reddish brown dye, which is kind of interesting. So in the garden, alder really is incredibly easy to grow and is incredibly easy to train to a manageable size and remove if needed. Alder is one of only 2 native nitrogen fixers here in Alaska. The other is Nootka lupine, Lupinus nootkatensis. Alders house a type of nitrogen fixing bacteria in nodules that form on their roots. And these bacteria, which feed on sugars received from the alder, absorb atmospheric nitrogen and in turn make it available to nearby plants. Sitka alder can fix around 55 pounds of nitrogen an acre. So this is the primary benefit of alder in the garden. It amplifies the fertility of the soil and boosts the growth of nearby plants. And while you could come up with a system of including alders trained small directly in an annual garden, where they really shine is in a perennial garden. In our sunrise garden, we keep about 11 of them. The main way we like to include alder in an annual patch, we keep three full grown alders on the north side of the garden. Doing it this way, it's important to keep the branches above trimmed back so the drip line is just behind the row crop. Otherwise, rain won't make it to the bed. Another reason larger alders are a boon to have in the garden is because come fall time, they drop a magnificent amount of leaf, which can be used as rich mulch all throughout the garden. And they also serve as a very effective nursery for freshly transplanted potted plants and new cuttings and starts needing to be hardened off. It's pretty magical, actually. They can nurse an otherwise sad plant to health pretty quickly just by setting it underneath the canopy of mature alders. As a general rule, alders in the heart of the perennial garden are kept 3 to 5 feet, depending on what type of plant they're sharing space with. And while alders on the edges and north side are kept at 10 to 15 feet tall, one of my favorite ways to crop out the shady understories of mature alders is a simple four-part perennial polyculture consisting of alder, ostrich fern, Betusia struthiopteris, nettle, and Siberian claytonia, Siberian miner's lettuce, Claytonia siberica, which all of these plants are actually native to Alaska. We planted it about 7 or 8 years ago, and it was originally inspired by natural polycultures that exist here on the peninsula. It yields an incredible amount of leaf food, you know, nettle shoots, fiddleheads, and salad greens from the Claytonia. It's a fantastic way to make the shady understory of alder patches productive. So an ostrich fern patch that we have recently planted under mature alders. These crowns are going on their second year in their new location. This spring, they'll be going into their third year. When we plant out underneath the alders, we do prepare the site by shaping the alders if needed. We'll open up the canopy by removing a trunk here or there and remove most of the low-lying branches to make room for working and harvesting. The primary reason for opening up the canopy is to make sure that the ferns are able to be rained on. Also to let in a little bit of sunshine with the ostrich ferns. They do like a little bit of high shade, a little bit of dappled sunlight. They want some of that, but they're really shade tolerant. The other reason for opening up the canopy is to make sure that the ferns can receive rain so that the canopy doesn't rob rain from them. It's really important that in the first, like the year that they've been transplanted, that those ferns get plenty of water. Most of the time when we're under there working with the soil, and if you find yourself inspired to do so, working the soil underneath mature alders is usually pretty soft and easy to work. You will have to work around roots, which gets trickier the closer you get to the base of the alder. So we usually kind of give room to the base of the alder just specifically because of that reason. But you can find really fertile little pockets in between the larger roots that work really well for certain types of plants. Ostrich fern is spread by rhizome. So when digging, it's worth being careful. When digging the crowns out, it's worth being careful to keep any runners as intact as you can. But if you break them, it's okay. They can be propagated just by that rhizome alone. And ostrich ferns are delicious, by the way. Definitely the choicest of the edible ferns native to Alaska, as they have little to no brown scaly calyx on the shoots, you know, as opposed to wood ferns or lady ferns. She usually have a good amount of that brown scaly stuff on the ferns, which you kind of got to wash off because it can cause a gastrointestinal distress. So, and once cooked, they have a lovely flavor. It is important to cook them. They have a vitamin B depleting enzyme in them. I think it's called thiamines or something. So it's good to cook the shoots good 10 minutes or so. But the ostrich ferns have a lovely flavor that's similar to like green bean and asparagus, combination of the two. It's definitely, ostrich fern is a perennial vegetable well worthy of planting large amounts of. It's very easy to propagate and manage as they spread by relatively short rhizome at a medium rate. And it's a great way to crop out the shady understory of mature alders. Put all of that shady, otherwise unusable, fertile ground to work.